for Sidings and an insurance banking attorney. Friday, June 12th, hearing room C, the agenda. SB 31, 115, 182, 708, 848.
Guider.
I think they're dead.
They're dead.
We can go get them.
They're like some of the bells in there.
You know, one of the nice things about it, they tried to close down committees, and you know what's going to be the last committee to close down? As long as the usury bill's here, they're not going to do anything.
That's right.
Are you sure everybody that's not here, the only ones that are there?
That's right.
Take you out and buy you whiskey as long as you have it in your committee.
That is an attention getter I've ever seen. I'm going to take up Senate Bill 708, the first bill today, which is the Mr. Bessonette's bill. Come on up, Tom. Please. For the committee members' attention, this is the, we're looking at the A and Gross bill, and this bill was originally introduced to panel a specific...
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, which bill are we on?
708, Senator. Senate Bill 708, you're looking at the A and Gross version, and the bill has changed somewhat from the way it was introduced. It was specifically, when the bill was introduced, it directed the issue that appears on page 2, line 37, section 8. And what happened was the Garrow decision, which was the question about whether the PIP coverage would apply to accidents in which motorcycles were involved, was Mr. It was in another bill that Mr. Bessonette had, but that bill has gained such wide notoriety that it's the bill that we all get the letters from periodically. They crank up the organization, and Senate Bill 30 has become infamous, if not famous. And so what he did is he looked for another vehicle to put his particular concern in, and Senate Bill 708 is it. We had another public hearing on the bill as it was amended, and the bill is ready to go except for one thing. And we have to take out the Section 8 beginning on line 37 of page 2 and line 1 and 2 at the top of page 3, which...
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that. It was an issue we discussed, and I asked some questions as it relates to my own personal nature, where my parents are both retired, and if my children were riding with their grandparents, conceivably they would be in a situation where they would not be covered. And I think for the small additional amount of premium that would be included, that it would be well worth it, and I would move that we delete Section 8 out of the bill.
You've heard the subsection 8. It begins on page 2, line 37 through 40, and in the top of page 3, lines 1 and 2. You've heard the motion. Is there any further discussion?
Oh, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Has Senator Wires had an opportunity to address that?
Yes, he has, and we're having a problem in reaching agreement on it. The problem is that the concept of it is one in which it is difficult to disagree with the fact that a person who is 65, and by the way, Senator Wires wanted it raised to 65, if in fact that you could ensure that they were the only ones that were ever going to drive the car or that would ever be in the car, you could do that. But it will not work, because what it would be the essence in saying that no one over 60, first of all, no one under 65 could drive the car because there'd be no PIP coverage on it. And secondly, no one under 65 could get in the car because there'd be no PIP coverage on it. And it had to do with, you could think of a variety of situations.
Well, how did Senator Wires, how was he going to solve that problem?
Well, he didn't have any ideas on that, and he said he didn't think of that. And what he thought of, it was what happened is a constituent of his was concerned about the fact that they reached 65 and they got Medicare. And but since Medicare covers this, they said, why do I have to pay this PIP coverage? And the problem is that I don't think PIP and Medicare are the same thing, because the Medicare is dealing with the individual. PIP coverage, as it's related, has a variety of situations which it applies to, not only to the owner of the vehicle, but also to all the passengers and all the other people who are involved with it.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting for me because here's a guy who wanted to get the guest passenger thing passed so badly, and I thought maybe he changed his mind and tried to go back the other way a little bit.
I'm going to tell you, in fact, that it would reduce, it wouldn't do it the liability, but the PIP coverage, it would cancel that out for him if, in fact, that the person was over 60.
Maybe that was the real underlying reason for what he was trying to do.
I could assure you of this one particular issue. There's many reasons why Senator Wires introduced this bill, but to cut away at the guest passenger repeal is not one of them.
Well, I'd noticed, Mr. Chairman, that there have been a lot of people taking some different attitudes this session, and I thought maybe it would be carried over in this area.
I can assure you that that is not true.
Trying to do, George. My trouble.
Well, my only concern was that Jan had an opportunity to, you know, if you've discussed it with him, that's fine. But I talked to him and also.
We just disagree. Okay. That's all I can tell you.
I might add, Mr. Chairman, if I might, that there are other benefits besides a medical and income loss that would benefit senior citizens. One would be the loss of essential services, which pays up to $18 a day. As an example, say the wife was injured in the automobile and was hospitalized. The Medicare pays a certain percentage of it. They do not. They have a $140 deductible. PIP pays that $140 deductible. They don't pay but 80% of the doctor's fees. We pay the other 20% of the PIP benefit. Then, because of the loss of the housekeeper and the cook and everything else, the husband could, in fact, bring someone in to do that essential services and pay them $18 a day. So there are some benefits that are there. Also, there's a $1,000 funeral benefit in case one of the senior citizens is terminated as a result of the accident.
Is there any further discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, and so adopted. You want to move it out?
Is there another section?
Oh, I'm sorry.
By?
There is. I am sorry. I'm glad you brought that up. There is another amendment that, this was adopted.
This is already adopted.
No. Okay. This is the amendment that's already been adopted, the Section 5 in concept, and it now reads, this act does not apply to any liability incurred or cause of action arising before the effective date of this act.
Okay, and that's already on the
Yeah, it's already in the bill. That's the way to go down to this whole amendment.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'd move A and Grove Senate Bill 708 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Hannemoon moves Senate Bill 708 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion?
That amendment is where again? Is that this one?
Yes, that is. Yeah. That is it. It's the that one was adopted, Judge, conceptually last time at the last time we had a public hearing on that, and that was the language that they put in.
That effectively takes care of any court cases pending? Is that the reason?
No, it does not. That's the reason for it. What it does, Senator Wires, Tom Bessonette with Oregon,
Wingard.
Senator Wingard, excuse me, is that it allows anyone who has an accident prior to the effective date of the act to make claim under the current court decision. And the effective date, obviously, is 90 days after you people adjourn. Therefore, any cause of action that originates prior to the effective date would still have the Garrow decision applying to it, but after that date, it would be cut off. And that clarifies very succinctly that we're not going to the Supreme Court this time to find out what the effective date is. Thank you.
Hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Bassett.
Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Gannon.
Aye.
Senator
Kitt
Hopper?
Aye.
Senator McFarland?
Aye.
Senator Wingard?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Senate Bill 708, as amended, is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. the, what I'd like to do is that, is there anyone here that, I know, Tom, you're interested in Senate Bill 31. I'm not ready to act on that. I'm going to roll it over until Tuesday.
Senate Bill which, Mr. Jones?
31. It's the underinsurance bill.
So you're not going to act on
that? No, we're not going to act on that today. The next two bills I would like to take up together are Senate Bill 150 and Senate Bill 182. Both of these particular measures. We're going to go to two bills, Senate Bill 150 and 182. Both of these bills, by the way, deal with the issue of health coverage for health insurance for retirees. And there's a letter here. A letter from Mr. Don Epley, who is the administrator of the Personnel Division, regards Senate Bill 150, 182 in a letter, and he supplied some information to us. And if you would look at both bills together, what they attempt to do, let me take Senate Bill 182 first. This was the issue. Remember that some time ago, the discussion between the Employees Benefit Board and the Bargaining Unit Benefit Board, and they had all these different things, and this question of whether, in fact, there would be a compulsion that one would, that they could take away the greater benefits that were being provided by I think it was the Bargaining Unit Benefit Board that provided the greater benefits. And this was the one that says, forbid State Employees Benefit Board and Bargaining Unit Benefit Board to contract for health care insurance coverage for retired members of PERS or that coverage provided by contract by retirement board. And what they were concerned about is that when these people retired, that the boards would provide for a better plan than that was provided by PERS. And what this wanted to do was to prevent them from somehow taking the retirees out and putting them under the PERS plan, or giving them that option, because the PERS plan was just, as far as benefits, was less lucrative to them than the plans they had under the Employees Benefit Board or the Bargaining Unit Benefit Board. The Senate Bill 150 required the Public Employees Retirement Board to enter into health care insurance contracts for retired PERS members. And this provided that half of the cost of the insurance be paid by retiree through retirement pay deductions and half by the public employers under PERS. Now, that particular measure had a fiscal impact on, yes, this is what I, on all employers. If this was made applicable to all employers, in the 83 biennium, they have an effect on revenues, if you look at it, of about $50 million.
This is 182 you're talking about?
No, this is 150. 150, which is the public employers pick up one half the cost. Now, it's the question, there are two separate issues. The one in 150, as I said, is the question of whether PERS is going to be required to provide a retirement fund in which one half of the cost of the retirement, I mean a retirement plan, where one half of it would be paid by the public employer to the state. And that's where the cost figure comes in. The other issue in 182 deals more with prohibiting the grouping of all retired public employees for a health care plan into the PERS. And is that correct, Mr. Parker? And that's what you object to.
Retirees, public employer, public employee retirees should be segregated as a separate risk group.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what the issue
and
is.
182 does that?
Yeah. Well, that's what it attempts to do. That's what it attempts to do.
Do we have amendments to that?
I thought that there were some amendments to it.
I have notes written on here, something about amendments.
Bill, is this?
Yeah, there were some. Well, I've got the TRFA. 182, if I'm not mistaken, that was, is Mr. Epley here today? That's one of your bills, isn't it, from the Executive Department?
Yes, sir.
See, they're the ones that basically have the plans that at the present time take their particular unit that provide a much better benefit for their retirees than the PERS system does. And what they would like to do, you would just like to move those people into another plan also. What it would basically do, if it had that passed, that all retirees, even though that they do provide the option, I understand, for the retirees to pick up their coverage, when they retire, just a second, that what they would do is that they would basically want, and the argument is that it would reduce their benefits over, I mean, their cost overall to the system if in fact that they could take the retirees and put them all into the public employee retirement system and then require whatever plan the retirement system has to provide that plan to them through that system. And that 150, though it isn't related directly to it, does impact on it because that would be a funding mechanism for the PERS to be able to pick up a retirement plan, a health insurance plan, excuse me, for all retirees. But the cost of it is, as you can see, is rather substantial.
What are the chances of getting 150 by ways and means?
Do they
worry whenever it's PERS?
You know, Senator, you know, that's the issue that obviously the public employees are going to have to address themselves to when they get down to the ways and means. I mean, there's just so many dollars, and they're going to have to make a decision of which of these bills they want to prioritize, whether they want to increase benefits, mm-hmm. you know, or whether, in fact, they want to increase the health insurance for retirees. I guess that I haven't seen a combination where they could get both of them yet. Now, 182, I would have to tell you that I think they could probably, the impact on that is rather minimal, the fiscal impact. It's the equity question involved in that, of whether in fact people who have substantial benefits at this time should in essence be told that we're not going to provide that plan for you any longer, and you're going to have to go up to the public employee retirement system, which has a less beneficial plan to you, and that is going to be the group that you're going to be put in. So, and if you remember Mr. McGoffin and Mr. Maul and these people that testified, they just do not have the financial resources at this time to provide the plan that the bargaining mm-hmm. unit benefits board and these other people provide without some mechanism to receive a contribution for it.
This
right, Mr. Maul?
This is the SEBB and the BUBB.
The bob and the sub and the pub. And
yeah.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Are there some retirees, state employee retirees, who are falling through the cracks now and are not receiving coverage that they might desire, either from these two boards that service the active employees primarily or from PERS? Is one of the reasons we're trying to set PERS up in the business is so that we can take care of some employees who are falling through the
Crocs?
I think they all are provided at some particular point.
Okay.
The problem is that purse, if you put them in priorities, at the very bottom providing the least benefits, the least lucrative plan, is the plan that's offered by purse.
Okay. So I'm trying to figure out what is the overwhelming reason why we need to make any change at all.
And Mr. Epley will tell you that the problem is that when they have their plan, which is with the Employees Benefit Board, State Employees Benefit Board, which is the management people. And if I recall his testimony, what the problem is that when they submit their plan and they look at the people who are in the plan, it costs them more because they are making available to the retirees that plan. It just costs them more money. And what he's saying...
Substantially more or a little bit?
I think that they're, if I'm not mistaken, what was it, a 50% increase or something that you were expecting? One of them testified to that. Mr. Epley. Why don't you come up here, since this is your bill?
For the record, Don Epley, Personnel Administrator, Personnel Division, Exec Department. The real issue here for the State Employee Benefit Board was one of, should the active employees subsidize the retired employees? You know, our plans have gotten substantially better over the years, and they've become very expensive.
Healthy people subsidize unhealthy people.
Right. I fully appreciate the whole process of a co-op, but this was the issue that the SEB board addressed and the exec department thought ought to raise.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Mr. Epley, is there any information you could provide the committee? We show a breakdown of those people that would, in fact, be retired that would also be covered by Medicare.
I'm not sure if we have those records or not. If Ralph Bolt could come up, he's the insurance manager, he might be able to answer that for you.
Would this type of health insurance be their primary source of health insurance, or would it be a supplement?
Well, what occurs at age 65, of course, is people go into a Medicare program. The early retirees can opt not to go into Medicare, and therein lays the other issue, where they keep selectively the best plan they can depending on what their health is.
Okay.
There's always health insurance programs available regardless of the age of the...
Well, I know, but what I'm trying to get at is, are we talking about a supplemental program, or are we talking about their primary source of medical health care?
By their choice, the primary source could be either the plan through us or through PERS or Medicare or Medicaid. It's the option of the employee up to a certain point.
Do you have a breakdown then of age that person that would be retiring prior to age 62 that would be considering this as his primary source of health care versus that person that would be exceeding that would probably be using Medicare as a primary source of health care?
I'm not sure if we have that breakdown or not. Ralph?
In the Ralph Bolt with the benefit board, in the people under age 65, let's see, I've got to do some subtraction. We have 2,400 people under the SEB board who are retirees covered by insurance. Of that group, pardon?
2,400?
Yes.
Okay.
Of that group, 900 are retirees over age 65 with Medicare.
900 over 65? Okay.
The group that is under 65 may continue, anyone who retires prior to age 65 may take the same plan of insurance that they have as an active employee with them into retirement. So if you had Kaiser or you had Blue Cross, you take it into retirement, and this year there will be some reduction in benefits. They won't be able to take advantage of the dependent dental benefit and so on into retirement, but they'll have the same programs that they've had previously. We're making a change come August 1, which just complicates it a little bit.
And who is primarily responsible for picking that up? The retired employee, or does the PERS pay a portion of it? Does the state pay a portion of it? Who is responsible for it?
We, as to the actual cost, the employee, the retiree, does not receive a state contribution. So the retiree pays the full premium rate, but invariably at the projected premium rate to cover the costs for the retirees for that year. But at the end of the year, when we look at the costs, the retirees use 2.5 to 4 times what they put in premium. So at the end of the year, if there are any credits or assets in the active employee account, the retiree deficits are charged against those assets. And invariably, the retiree account, the retiree people have a loss.
So, in other words, you're charging that off against those active employees, and that is where the rub comes in.
Yes. In other words, the active employees are subsidizing the retiree.
Mr. Chairman, go ahead. Yeah. But, if what you have is a permanent operation over time, eventually those active employees are going to be retirees, and they're going to be subsidized by other active employees.
I'm not questioning.
All right. So what's so much wrong with that?
Well, originally
Except the rates are higher. How much higher are the rates than they would be otherwise? If you could dump all of these people who've been with you and put them over into PERS, and I'm saying dumping because that's what it seems to me like you're doing. You're dumping these people off onto PERS. And what kind of rates, how many people are you going to dump, and what rate decrease will you pay?
It took an extra 4% increase on the premium for active employees to subsidize the rates this year.
How much is it?
Pardon?
How much is it? How much? Put it in dollars. 4% doesn't mean anything. I don't know. 4% of what?
We've got about a $15 million a year premium. And 4%.
What does that translate out to each individual? Can you do it that way?
Not too much.
Okay, well. So what I'm trying to figure out is how much, you know, additional burden are you carrying because these retirees are still with you? Because you're going, when you put them into PERS, you're going to give them less benefits, and you're going to put more cost on the PERS system and employers and some other things. Going to be added costs there. So you haven't convinced me why we should do this. I can't see why we should do it. Can you convince me why we should do it?
Originally, House Bill 1462 in 1971 asked this board or this commission, the State Employees Benefit Board, to buy insurance for active employees. And because employees petitioned and because we took it upon ourselves to give retirees insurance under our active employee program.
Did you grandfather in a lot of retirees that hadn't been previously with the state in some kind of insurance program?
We brought everybody in back to 1972, January 1st of 1972. We took the retirees from that point on.
And these were people who had previously not been in any kind of program. See, Seb and Bub just are recreations of something that had been in existence, which was a single board, right?
Yes.
Yeah, what was that called? I forgot.
State Employees Benefit Board.
Okay, now, these retirees that you're talking about that you took in are people who had not been under that previous board?
No, they had been under the board.
Okay, so basically, you know, what we've done is we've bifurcated a single board. And we've had a responsibility to a whole lot of people. And the two boards took that over, one administrative employees, the other OSEA employees, OPU employees, and so forth. And the tradition has been to keep the retirees, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, in both situations. So now what you want to do is to change that tradition and move those retirees out and make them a responsibility of PERS, right?
Yes, sir.
I just can't understand why.
purse is
except
always...
Except it's going to cost you less money. It's going to cost purse more money. It's going to give them less coverage. So why does it make sense for us to do it? I can see why it makes sense for you to want it, perhaps, except is anybody groaning about the rates you're paying? Who's groaning? Who's crying? I'm a state employee.
Mr. Epley, let's hear a groan.
It's much too early in the morning for me to do that.
To groan.
Sure.
I'll just sigh a little bit.
Well, you know, there is really no way to come to a speech that will convince you that this is absolutely the thing to do. I mean, I don't even believe that.
You don't believe it's the thing to do, but it's a thing to do.
It is an issue that we looked at as an executive department and a benefit board. The retired employee pays the